Tonight on the Steve and Dan podcast, Steve and Dan discuss episode 507 of The Walking Dead, Crossed. Hi, I'm Steve.
Hi, and I'm really, really sorry.
This is not Dan's fault, but we did have a bit of a screw-up this week on our podcast.
Yeah, big time, man. This is the second time Steve and I have recorded this this podcast.
New and efficient.
We were right at the end of recording. When was this?
It was Tuesday night because I was in Seattle, which is my fault right off the bat. Although
right.
I won $200 at the Tulalip Casino. I want to add that right now.
Yeah, Steve was having a great time in Seattle. For once, we always record the show on Mondays usually because we want to get this out as soon as we can. So we're recording on Tuesday, and so I was in a different studio from usual, I suppose you could say.
And we were an hour and 15 into recording.
Just about to press stop, and then suddenly there's a power cut. I'm plunged into total darkness.
And thank God I'm stuck on a laptop which has a battery backup, so even if my power went out, I'm fine.
So I get home to edit, and the file's there, everything's good, but then when I open up the file, it's 0 kilobytes, there's nothing there.
So I suggested to Dan that he just go ahead and try to record based off my voice, but unfortunately that just didn't work.
Nah, it won't get happen. So we're going to run through it again. So we're going to sound even more tired and hackneyed than usual.
For us, this is a repeat. For you guys, this is all brand new and fresh.
So we are discussing tonight episode season 5, episode 7. The title of this one is Crossed.
This is despite the fact that we are literally 3 days away from episode 8, but don't worry about that. We'll have a new podcast up for you guys next week.
Steve, I can't work out whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that we're doing this again, because I had a lot of rage towards this episode first time we recorded it.
I really suspected that, as all old men do, your rage would sort of dissipate over time, but in fact, you seem to be quite angry at this point.
Yeah, no, because now I'm just annoyed that I have to talk about it again.
Should I mention the fact that I've actually got stupid written 5 times beside my episode notes?
I did enjoy this episode.
Oh,
I thought there were some really, really nice moments to it, but it was by far the dumbest episode of the season.
Now, okay, we got to be clear here, though. When we say the dumbest episode of this season, we're saying that it was better than every single episode of season 2. Yes?
Yeah, there's a lot of bad... I mean, there's a few bad things we can say about this episode, but one thing it wasn't at any point was boring.
It was entertaining, yes.
Yeah, it was always colourful, and the action's still moving. Sure, we're in a bit of a lull. It's to be expected. This is largely a setup episode for next week's mid-season finale.
Does it entertain us? Ultimately, yes. Television is really about entertainment, but this one did advance the narrative, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, that made no sense. Fuck that.
No, I'm keeping that in, man.
Okay.
Everything stays in tonight, all right?
It's in. This is the first and exclusive unedited Steve and Dan show.
Yeah, this is uncut.
Absolutely. Except pretend we're live. We're live right now.
Except for when I stumble over my words or tell a bad joke that doesn't pull off. Edit that out.
I just want to point out that never happens. Dan's incredibly lucid. I'm going to have a sip of my scotch at this point. By the way, this show is brought to you by Delmore 15 Year, at least on my end of it.
Yeah, mine of it is some nondescript bad red wine that I found in my neighbor's house. The season so far has been fairly typical.
What the fuck's that? What's
now, fuck, that doesn't even work.
I don't know.
Okay, so the storylines have diverged, but they have to converge for the mid-season finale.
Guaranteed.
That's how you build tension.
Well, I honestly think, with the exception of the Abraham and Glenn group, I don't think they're going to come back in time.
Are you done?
No, I really don't. I know that there were sort of indications in that sense, but I think that they're going to be on the road. I don't think they're going to be together in episode 8.
Right.
I could be wrong. But
so their role this week was what? Light entertainment?
Their role is to show us how to fish in the post-apocalypse.
Show us how to fish.
And play with yo-yos.
All right, so our plan tonight is to
talk
about the show, not chronologically the way that we often do, but we're going to sort of split it up into each one of its 4 main storylines.
There's basically 3 main storylines with a split, right? So do you want to start with the Graham group?
Yeah, we're going to start with the Graham group because they're kind of the least relevant.
Exactly, and Graham is the stupidest name ever for a group. I just
and how could you get it tattooed on your knuckles? It's only 6 letters.
Graatm.
I mean, you're going to leave out your pinky, right?
Well, Tara only has 6 fingers on both hands, so total.
She only has 6 fingers on each hand.
She total. I mean, she's
so she can have Graham on each hand.
Oh, wait a second. You're right. Okay.
She's Anne Boleyn. That's what you're saying.
I don't think Tara can count very well. In fact, I really suspect that she's somewhat mentally...
What should we say? Retrograde.
But in the post-apocalyptic world, I don't know if her skill set...
Beggars can't be choosers, man.
Well, her skill set, man. That ain't gonna help much, you know? Mm. When you think about it, go back to the beginnings of Tara. Okay, we've got that whole...
Yeah, let's talk about Tara. That's right. Because we wanted this recording to go quick, Steve.
Oh, fuck.
So what we need is a huge detour into a character that we hardly ever discussed.
So she finds a yo-yo.
No, let's fucking do it. No, come on. You want to talk about Tara? Let's talk about Tara.
Okay, the first time we ever meet her, she's in that lovely little kind of encapsulated world within a world inside that apartment building that the governor finds, right?
Yeah.
She's never been outside. She was training as a cop, but she failed.
So we think Tara would have made a poor police officer, is what we're saying.
She would not have made a good police officer because she's not intelligent enough, frankly.
No. She's the apocalypse is a saving grace for her.
It makes her look smart because she's one of the few people still alive. Yeah.
Well, she seems to specialize in being aimless. You know, she's in her element. She seems to enjoy the fact that no one really knows what's going on. No, it's absolutely perfect. She's got a captive audience now. Nothing's expected of her in particular.
The best moment for this episode, okay, just jump ahead again for a second, was she finds a bag amongst three walkers that they kill.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, "You're not going to believe what I found in this backpack." And she's all excited about it, like it's a huge, important discovery. What is it she found, Dan?
We think it's a yo-yo.
And we're pretty sure it's a yo-yo.
It's not totally... Look, I was thinking about this. It's not totally confirmed. We're presuming it's a yo-yo. There was the suspense, then the, the reveal.
She's playing with the yo-yo, like, 2 minutes later.
But that might have been a bait and switch.
I still think the yo-yo is actually representative of a deeper sadomasochistic role that she's playing with Glenn.
Yeah, she's tugging on his string. He's bouncing up and down.
And Glenn is pretty fucked up in this episode, right?
Yeah.
I mean, his wife... Okay, no, we're jumping all over the place, but I just want to say his wife is stuck with a psychopath.
Yeah.
Whom she's just had a face-off with a gun. And what's he doing? He's off teaching the other ladies how to fish. It's just completely insane, actually.
Now, we've well and truly fell off the plausibility wagon in this episode.
Okay,
so we might as well recap where we are at this point.
So this is the Gradom group, yeah, right?
Yeah, the Gradom group.
Which is Tara's idea, by the way.
Yeah, Tara's idea. It's the acronym based on the first letters of all letters. You fucking know this already.
Well, they know that, but we should tell them because we have to pretend that they don't know that.
Well, Steve, we're bringing this podcast is going to be out on Friday if we're lucky.
Are you serious? Oh, everybody already knows. Sorry, guys.
So they're on the fire truck. They can't get across that field. They're not going to Washington. Eugene's been knocked out. No one knows what to do. Abraham's gone catatonic. He's been transported back to his existential crisis. You know, the only reason that he was going on was that he believed, or sort of chose to believe.
I have a point to my life.
Yeah, chose to believe, in my opinion, that Eugene actually knew what was going on.
Well, when you consider how he found him, like, literally with a gun in mouth, right?
Yeah.
He was willing to believe anything at that point to survive.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think Abraham should be too mad at Eugene. But anyway, Abraham's broken down. Rosita tries to bring him round, but he slaps the water away.
Maggie pulls a gun, says, you know, kneel or get down or I'll put you down.
Right, so there's some serious tension between those two characters. Tara finds out that the truck has run out of water and someone's going to have to go and get some supplies. So what do they do?
There's literally 6 bottles of water left.
Let's just leave Maggie with Abraham.
Alone, because obviously they're getting along really well.
Yeah.
And things will be fine.
Yeah, because he's slapping water bottles and being unresponsive and, you know, has just beat someone to within an inch of their life.
So Glenn thinks it's a good time to fuck off with 2 other women and let Maggie alone with the psychopath.
Yeah, it's a weak-ass idea leaving those two alone, especially when we don't even know if Eugene might actually be dead. I mean, he could be turning at any point. We don't know. He's unconscious. You know, you get hit in the head that hard. It's not inconceivable you can die, especially as they've left him lying on his back, on his own.
In the sun.
As you pointed out, only recently decided to cover him up to save him from exposure. He could be swallowing his tongue or expiring.
This is the Walking Dead post-apocalyptic suspension of disbelief world. But you can only suspend your disbelief so much. The guy's dead.
Yeah.
The guy is dead by now.
Uh-huh.
For Maggie to turn her back on him is just a really huge mistake. And I think it's a problem. I've been rethinking this, though. We're going to talk a little bit later about what happens with Sasha, right?
Mm.
Maybe it's some sort of a foreshadowing in the sense that certain people you can turn your back on. Certain people you can't.
What?
I think so.
There's some people you can't. I don't even know what you're talking about.
I know, but we'll get there. I'll help you. Hold my hand, Dan.
Hold my hand and accompany me to the creek.
Yes, let's go to the creek where they're filling bottles with murky, horrible water.
Yeah.
But thankfully, Thankfully, a useless member of the party has taught Rosita how to filter the water. Who was that useless member of the party?
It's Mr. Eugene.
Indeed, Eugene, who is totally useless and, you know, a member of the party that they could just do away with.
All right, so Eugene's admitted that he's not a scientist, but his behavior so far has shown that he does know a few things about science. As you mentioned in the last episode, a couple of episodes ago, he made fire from a battery, something that surprised me. He came up with the idea of busting his way out of the container by hitting a cartridge. That never actually happened, but it seemed kind of smart to me. We're clearly, the point of this scene is to establish the fact that the rest of the group wouldn't mind having Eugene around. Not only are people like Tara affectionate towards him and just think that it's worthwhile keeping someone alive for their own sake, but it seems like he might have a little bit of use for the group. Fine, we get it. But what else is the point of this scene of Tara and Rosita hanging out fishing?
Well, really, that's the only point. The only thing that actually pushes the narrative forward is that. And then there's this whole bonding thing between Glenn, Tara, and Rosita, which is just, frankly, to be honest, awkward. Because Glenn is heavily flirting, especially with Rosita.
Uh-huh. Do you think... I didn't get that at all. I just thought they were just acting like children.
Okay, well, I guess I think children are flirting with each other. I don't know.
this is going into a direction I didn't want to take it.
So I'm not trying to say that there's anything untoward or bad happening here. I'm just saying that, yeah, there is. I agree with you. There's definitely childlike, but there's a childlike innocence, but there's also kind of a nefarious underside to it, kind of the adult underside to it at the same time. And nothing against Tara. I think Tara is really cool for who she is. She's definitely kind of that 9-year-old or 8-year-old innocent.
I actually like her. I think that these scenes were intended to be light relief because there's a lot of grimness going on in this episode. You know, some joyless scene setting for the next episode.
Oh, and we know there's going to be deaths, right? I mean, there's
going to be plenty of deaths, for sure.
Yeah.
But that's not really why I like Tara. I like her just because she's weird.
I like her because she's awkward.
Yeah.
There's no more awkward fist bump than the Tara fist bump.
Yeah.
And she's constantly trying to give it to people, and people are like, what are you doing?
Yeah, and it's a character that doesn't just slavishly adhere to stereotypes, you know? Every other character just has their niche, the thing that they do. But she's reliably weird.
I agree. I like her. I do like her for that.
Yeah, I like her a lot. More power to her.
Did you realize we're at 19 and a half minutes and we're still on?
Yeah, we need to we did this last time as well, man. Like, even my batteries are going to run out this time.
Ultimately, what happened was they went out. He saw a bit of a ripple in the little pond they were at, said, hey, you know what that means? Fish.
Must be.
Because none of them would realize that. I was really hoping for zombie fish at this point because it was kind of this weird, slow moment that didn't make sense with the rest of the episode.
Yeah, I was just hoping for a zombie. There was a scene back at the farm, I remember, when some of the kids were hanging out by a pit and some zombie just came up out of the ground.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Mate. So the whole scene with Graham winds up with them returning from their fishing expedition with a fish and a yo-yo, and a renewed sense of optimism and good feeling towards Eugene. Kumbaya, and they come back kind of a good time, because Maggie has spent a little while...
Kumbaya. Oh, sorry. I was lost there for a second.
Yeah, Jesus fucking Christ, Steve. Do you want us to get this thing done or not?
No, fuck that. I want this to be our special 2-hour show is what I want this to be.
All right, let's do it.
So basically, they're back there, and the interesting thing that happens before Glenn and them show back up is that... Maggie approaches Abraham and tells him to smarten the fuck up. She's like, basically, dude, you gotta snap out of this. I've been there. I know what you're going through. It's not acceptable in this world. Abraham kind of twitches but doesn't react until they hear what sounds at first, obviously, because they're trying to plant this in our head, like a walker. But it's Eugene. And then at that point, Abraham takes the water in his left hand. Again, his left hand, and picks it up. And that's our last scene of them, right?
Yeah, you can tell Abraham wants to... You can see in his eyes he wants to run and hold Eugene.
Yeah, he does. He actually looks happy that Eugene is waking up.
And he does love Eugene.
Of course he does. He does. You only hurt those you loved.
Sure. Right, so we're going to move on to the hospital.
Well, indeed.
So we are in the post-Noah escape when Beth seems to have been brought back into the group.
She's got a lovely new wound on her forehead, by the way.
Yeah, she does. She's got a couple, actually. They look like caterpillars.
Yeah, one on the cheek, one on the forehead. These are you know, courtesy of our favorite constable, Officer Don Lerner.
Yeah, and I can only presume that Beth has stitched them herself, looking at the state of them.
They're not very well done.
So we said that the show is a bit annoying. It really starts here for me. The first scene that we get in the hospital is of Beth mopping at the floor, doing it. That seems to be all these orderlies do, by the way. Yes, yeah, so Beth is listening to these cops. So they're saying, oh, we think we might have heard Noah. We better go after him and get him.
And it's important to note this for a few minutes later when we're going to be talking about this, that he seems to think this is about a mile away, right?
Yeah, a mile away. He says, we heard shots about a mile away.
People know guns. You know, if there's a shot from a decent gauge gun, you know you can hear it from a good mile away, probably more.
Yeah, especially in a city that's pretty quiet these days.
Oh, yeah, there's not even traffic background, there's no helicopters, there's nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a gunshot's going to definitely stand out.
Yeah, for sure. So that's not the only thing that Dawn and the officer talk about. She says, is there anything else? He says, yeah, well, actually, like, suddenly I've got a big conscience about what we're spending all our money on here at this hospital. And that new lady that we brought in, she's not in very good shape. She's taking up a lot of intensive care resources. Can we not just turn them off?
This is a really wonderful moment for Beth. She walks forward and says, how much energy does your DVD take?
Mm-hmm. So she decides it's time to cut him off. So she's like, how dare you?
You sorry son of a bitch.
He's just trying to keep culture alive, right?
And Dawn backs him up. So what else does Beth expect? I mean, Dawn is already, we know she's a weak leader, so she comes in and she tries to embarrass her in front of one of her cops.
No, Dawn spells it out pretty much. She says, you know how tenuous my position is, Beth. Jesus Christ, why did you do that?
You just killed that woman.
However, here's the key to the medicine cabinet for some reason.
There is definitely a suspension of disbelief being asked of us at this point. I don't entirely give it to them.
No. Why do you think that Dawn gave the key to her? Do you think that this is just a bit of kindness from her? Do you think that she's actually impressed with her strength? Or do you agree with Dr. Edwards, who Beth speaks to in the next scene in the hospital, who suspects that Dawn's given the key to her for some perhaps less wholesome purposes?
I would think that there's actually, that Dr. Edwards is correct. And the reason for this is that if you consider Dawn and her life in the hospital, she is in a retrenched kind of position. She knows mm-hmm. that the other cops are against her. She knows that she doesn't have true power, that she's having to negotiate power constantly, right? Who was her greatest ally before? Noah. Noah is gone. Who's Beth? Beth is Noah's replacement, as far as she's concerned. She's right. going to try and get in. The funny thing is, you see this sometimes in bullying situations where the bully will try to create an ally out of one of the bullied. And she's doing that with Beth. She's trying to create an ally because she needs that ally at this point, although she feels herself to be in a dominant position, so she can then motivate that new ally to do what she needs her to do.
But Beth goes for it. So she goes to see Dr. Edwards, and she's like, all right, Dr. Edwards, what is the best car crash medicine that you can recommend, hypothetically?
The car crash medicine.
Dr. Edwards figures it out straight away. He's still bleating on about it. He still feels bad, obviously.
And I just did it to sheepish. Save my own life.
Yeah, I was trying to save my life, and I'm not really sure if I have.
But I could die any time.
This is a hospital. It should be the safest place, but I feel so at risk. So, anyway, he's like, this is the stuff you need. It doesn't matter. You'll probably screw it up like you did last time. So he's like, just leave me to my guinea pigs. So she's got a plan. So Beth has a plan. She knows that the big fat old guy who lives just down the corner from the medicine cabinet.
Loves strawberries.
Immense penchant for strawberries. So she gets a couple of his favorite crimson fruit. And,
did you say penchant, by the way?
Yes.
Oh, I love that.
Puts it in his hand. He has a fetish for them, I think. You see the way he cups them?
Yes, he lovely testicles.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I was going to say he cups them like a pair of young boys' testicles. he's a strange man. So he grips his strawberries.
He's a strange man, and we've only known him for 15 seconds, which I love, because sometimes you see these people for 15 seconds, and they simply die. This guy has a penchant for young boys' testicles.
That's the thing. When he gets the strawberries, like, he collapses immediately onto the floor and does his diversionary thing. A sudden cough.
I'm just dying here.
Cupping the strawberries in his hand, which presumably are contraband. This is his thing, right? It isn't just the idea of having young boys' testicles in his hands that he likes the idea of. His fantasy is being caught with young boys' testicles in his hands. Being caught by policemen who then overcome him in a corridor.
He's got a cop fetish, that's what it is. Speaking of young boys' testicles, does this not take you back, in fact, to a movie involving a young Christian Bale we were talking about the other day?
Yeah, that's right. I feel like Beth was really playing the role of the young procurer, the streetwise kid on the ward. And she kind of reminded me of Christian Bale's character in Empire of the Sun.
Empire of the Sun, excellent.
The Steven Spielberg-directed adaptation of J.G. Ballard's excellent book, in which a young James Ballard is in the Lungua prison camp.
Have you done some research, Dan?
No, I didn't do any research at all. This stuff is readily there on the front of my mind, but it's only because I'm a big J.G. Ballard fan.
This is just knowledge. This is the fucking knowledge.
But yeah, like, she's the streetwise kid who, you know, knows the way around the ward. She can get you some contraband if you need it, you know, that kind of thing. She's only been there for about a week, but it seems like this is what we're supposed to believe is
they're
happening.
Fucking with our heads a little bit, I have to say, because you've got the situation where, in the perception of watching it, it feels like it's been months, right? Because we know it's been months between our viewings because of the simple fact of the hiatus they have between seasons 4 and 5. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at the timing of the show, we're literally talking 7 to 10 days, yeah.
Yeah.
Very short time.
But everyone else in this hospital seems to be in a state of disrepair. I mean, there's the kind of, there's the group of women who seem to be there as basically comfort women.
Comfort women, yeah. We're talking about World War II Japanese comfort women stolen from Korea, or in this case, the suburbs of Atlanta.
Yeah, so if you're not one of the comfort women, then you're one of these kind of helpless auxiliary people, like the old guy, or Noah, who's just this kind of weak, spindly person.
Although
so
we did argue that perhaps he was a plaything for Dawn, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was more implied than anything else. But yeah, it's a nice idea.
I think he has a dolphin smooth ass. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to have to fucking edit some of this. So anyway, so the diversion works. Beth gets to go in and spend a tender moment with Carol, right? I just wanted you to know I was here.
She does the epinephrine. Like, the epinephrine is the drug. She puts in the saline solution into the very conveniently still placed... whatever you call that thing where you put in epinephrine shit.
We didn't know it the first time we recorded. Yeah, no, we said catheter.
I should have done research.
We've got no idea.
It's not a catheter. A catheter goes in the urethra.
It's the veiny bag.
The veiny bag. She applies the veiny bag and injects
thank
the epinephrine.
God it's a medicine that doesn't require crushing up.
Thank God, because she was really horrible at that.
If we are to speculate on the purpose of this scene, it's a tender moment between two characters. Doesn't really seem to serve much purpose in the context of
this
show.
It does serve a purpose. It does serve a purpose, because what does Beth say? I want you to know I was here.
I was here.
I was
That's
here.
Right.
Past tense, right?
And as we find out later, for anyone who's watched the preview for next show or just looked on the IMDb entry, the next episode is titled Coda.
Coda.
Now, what would the significance of coda be, Steve?
Coda is a Latin term, and I believe it means end.
It means the end, and it is commonly used as a musical term, which means the end of the song or the end of the musical piece.
Who do we associate with music in the show?
Bear McCreary.
Bear McCreary, yes.
So what they're saying is that Bear McCreary is likely to die in the next episode?
I'm pretty sure of that.
And this is the end of a soundtrack for this show.
Yeah, but if we were to look at characters, who do we associate with music?
Father Gabriel, because he has the pipe organ in his church and the pipe organ was disassembled.
Daryl, because he digs the pipe organ into the ground and... No.
The singer...
The singer.
The singer, Beth.
Beth. Oh, shit. You're right.
So the title coda seems to me to be suggesting that song is coming to an end. So the tender scene with Carol would make a lot of sense if Beth is to die in the next episode, which I think all the smart money is on. I think it might well happen. Or she will at least be implied to have died.
Well, the more effective death would obviously be Carol, right?
Yeah,
I suspect that the two of them are definitely in danger into this next season. This next episode. And we have, you know, there are some indications it's going to be bad. Now, there was a video or a GIF file released just recently that purportedly is from episode 8 and the filming of episode 8, and it shows Norman Reedus crying as Daryl.
A lot has been made of that.
Who would make Daryl cry? Probably either Beth or Carol, right?
But this season, you know, the leaks and the previews have been kind of deliberately misleading.
Dude, it's not just this season. Like, I do previews of most episodes, and I try to extrapolate upon what I see in the sneak peek videos, and very rarely does it have anything to do with the actual episode. And it's not just in the sense of misleading in what they show you, but it's in the order they show you quite often. Like, if they show you more than one thing, they'll do it in different, like, totally out of order from what the episode actually shows you.
It might be a good idea. You know what? It might be interesting to go back and look at all the previews.
Yeah, and see if there's, like, some sort of pattern to it, right?
Yeah, you could probably come up with their deception algorithm.
Ooh.
And crack it, you know. You could probably, like, you could, like, run an Enigma code on every preview and
Robert
work
Kirkman,
out
what... I can read you like a frickin' book, dude.
Yeah, you can work out what actually will happen just based on the bullshit they've tried to pull in the past.
I blame Scott Gimple, actually.
Yeah, yeah, sure, why not? What we're going to do now is we're going to go on to the church. We need to start up when the whole gang is there together. Daryl has obviously... We never actually see this part played out, but Daryl has actually obviously returned with Noah. Noah has filled everyone in on the details of the hospital, and they've hatched a basic sort of plan that they're going to head off to the hospital and try to free both Carol and
interestingly,
Beth.
Interestingly, the basis of this plan includes dismantling the pipe organ.
Yeah, this is the important first step. Now, why are they dismantling the pipe organ, Steve?
Because they're setting up a random fence of anti-zombiehood.
Yeah. Were we seeing it, like, half-made? Because it didn't seem to make any sense at all. Because I remember what Morgan's compound was really intelligently set up with spiked instruments pointing outwards.
And random pathways, so that basically as the zombies or the walkers came in towards Morgan's house, they were going to be skewered.
They would impale themselves. But these pipe organ pipes seem to be set up at a jaunty angle, if anything, just to decorate the entrance to the church.
Yeah, it more or less looks like a, here's the entrance, come this way. Yeah, pretty much.
But whatever. The point of this is that they're defending the church because there's a few more vulnerable members of the show who are hunkering down. And they are, you know, predictably Judith, Carl's getting used to being left on his own, Father Gabriel, who's just, you know, presumably completely pathetic. And then, surprisingly, Michonne and not Tyrese, who is the babysitter-in-chief, in a decision that might come back to haunt me.
I suspect this is simply a narrative choice because they're planning on killing either Tyrese or Sasha.
Oh, you think so?
And, you know, okay, I'm Rick. Okay, I'm Rick. I'm looking Tyrese, who can't kill anything.
No.
Or Michonne, who's a fucking ninja, right? It doesn't make any narrative sense whatsoever to take Tyrese unless there's some point to Tyrese being there.
You know, I was kind of hoping that Tyrese might get killed, but I didn't...
You're going to piss off a lot of comic book readers here.
Yeah, I didn't think that my hope was that realistic. Now, I kind of presumed that from the perspective of the showrunner, the reason for having Tyrese go along is that we need this silly interchange between him and Sasha, which illustrates the fact that Sasha is still really torn up about Bob. Like they delve back into the whole, oh, I should have been able to kill him myself, and Tyrese is like, oh, but you know, you did a really good job.
I was there. It was good. I'm your brother.
Don't worry. Yeah, he'd be ever so proud of you. Yeah, this just seems to be to communicate to us the fact that she hasn't got over it, simply to rationalize a really dumb decision she makes with another character called Bob.
Because obviously, if he's named Bob, he must be like, you know.
Yeah, like Tyrese, to me, the way I read it, he's only going along to serve that function so we can see that Sasha's still upset.
It's a pretty weak.
To put pressure on Rick not to go through with his rather belligerent plan and instead to plump for a little bit of a more risky maneuver. It's something we'll talk about in a bit. But I hadn't thought about the possibility that he might, you know, end up getting it in the neck.
I suspect he might, but I mean, Sasha could too.
Those guys leave. Their initial plan is just to go and storm
the
place.
I love the fact there's actually this kind of a really interesting mirroring that happens. So you got Daryl and the gang creating this fortress, right? They're trying to, and I say fortress, you can't see this, but I'm doing these scare quotes as I say fortress. It's a completely useless bunch of fortifications outside the church, but they're not the only ones making modifications to the church.
No.
Who else is making modifications to the church?
Father Gabriel.
Carl.
A couple of key modifications.
Exactly. Carl decides he's going to be the teacher, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's learned.
Well, at the beginning of the show, the main modification Gabriel is making is a frantic attempt to clean up the blood that's on the floor.
And this is actually one of my favorite moments in the episode when he actually literally gets down on the floor. He's looking at Gareth's blood in the floorboards, and he tries scratching it out. Here, I'm going to do a scratching sound. That's exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah, with your fingernail.
It's horrible.
On a well-worn floorboard. Can't imagine anything more annoying.
And yeah, it's horrible. Well, I can. It's called like fingernails on a blackboard.
Hmm. Although, and you're not going to get that blood out.
No.
Have you seen, just interestingly, so Father Gabriel's down there trying to get the blood out with his fingernails. Have you seen Deadwood?
I saw a few episodes of Deadwood. I did not watch the entire series. Sorry.
Oh, Deadwood, what a show. But Al Swearengen, played by Ian McShane.
Oh, Ian McShane is brilliant.
Oh, Swearengen, one of the best characters.
My favorite quote from him is, motherfucker.
Oh, yeah. And just cunt. But yeah, he spends a lot of time like down on his knees clearing blood up off from the floor of his bar, and he says there's a real art to it. Like, you have to scrub for days, you know. You ain't getting out with any fingernail. So yeah, so everyone leaves, and Father Gabriel is kind of milling around looking glum.
And Carl's like, Carl's suddenly the psychopath Carl again, right? You remember, yeah, we had the psychopath Carl that killed that young boy from Woodbury back in season 3.
Mm-hmm. Carl is no longer a psychopath. He's come through that. He is now just extremely well adjusted for his environment.
And ultimately, he's a pragmatist, much like Carol. He's actually much more like Carol than Rick is like Carol in a lot of ways. So he literally lays out the weapons they have amongst them and says to Father Gabriel, choose one. You have to pick one because you're going to need to be able to fight for yourself. And it's not like in a weird kind of, pick a weapon, you pussy bastard. He's completely like, you know, this is pragmatic. I know you don't like to fight. I know you've never killed. But you're going to have to pick a weapon because if you're going to be with us, you have to be able to look after yourself.
And not only that, it's a matter of style, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you need to choose your flavor. Like, Carl's always sporting that cowboy hat, yeah?
Yes, that's true.
Like, Carl's got a good sense of aesthetics. So he's like, look at you, Gabriel. You're a good-looking guy. You're kind of tall. You got that nice outfit, you know? You need to get your weapon.
I saw you in The Wire. You were really good.
Yeah, you were excellent in The Wire. You know, you wore that badge well. Now you need a new badge.
So which one do you want? And so what does Father Gabriel do? He reaches over and he very carefully pinches between two fingers. Sort of, gingerly, yes. Gingerly.
Is it gingerly?
It is gingerly. He picks up one of the machetes.
So he picks it up.
Carl's first response is awesome.
Yeah.
You're holding Carl's it all like, wrong.
You can't hold it like that, you twerp. You need to be able to jam it down. Sometimes their heads are too soft. And Gabriel gets his usual bilious attack.
Oh, I'm not feeling well. I have to go lie down.
I'm going to lie down.
I have to lie down.
Now, all the time when Carl is giving this talk to Gabriel about smashing heads off and stuff, Michonne, the camera pauses on Michonne and her eyes open really quite wide, and I felt like they were trying to communicate something with that stare.
Do you realize-
now, I interpret it as her being sort of impressed or somewhat in awe of Carl's taking charge of the situation. Did you read it the same way?
I did. And do you realize that Michonne herself in the whole episode has one line?
Oh, when she goes to talk to Gabriel later on?
Well, yeah, not only is it one line, but it's the stupidest line in the whole show.
Yeah,
go
on.
She literally says, even though the things that we do, they're worth it. What? So there's like a huge gap there as to like meaning.
That's even like a things, Buddhist koan.
I think what she's missing is, even though the things that we do really bother you because they're extremely nasty and sometimes hurt people and kill people, they're worth
it. Yeah,
you know?
I think what she's missing is a verb.
Well, like a verb, two pronouns, maybe a couple of nouns, an article or three. Yeah, she's missing
some,
a
and
sentence.
Some affect.
Yeah, she has no tone.
No,
but yeah. So unfortunately for Michonne, and I love Michonne. She's actually become one of my favorite characters. She developed a lot in season 4.
I like her more now. I got off my initial disappointment when we first introduced to her. It seems like she's going to be incredible. But she's rather depressed. All right, so Michonne's exchange, her brief lines, the only lines that she delivers today are to Gabriel, who has secluded himself in his back room with
really,
the machete.
He looks really, really nervous when she comes to the door, too.
He does.
Why is he nervous, Dan?
We're supposed to think he's nervous because he's just a nervous character who's not particularly happy about
his violence.
Oh, yeah,
that's right. He's got that weak stomach, right?
He has got a weak stomach. But you know what? I mean, the first time I watched this, I was thinking, Father Gabriel's acting rather shifty. Why is he so reticent and withdrawn? But if you really look at his experience of this group, he's only known them for a very short amount of time. And in that short amount of time, both Sasha and Rick have squared up to him and basically threatened his life.
Plus, he's slaughtered.
And an enormous bloodbath has taken place on the floor of his church.
Which is
so
the best thing.
So he really doesn't have much in the way of good cause to trust these people, other than the fact that they hauled him off that rock that he'd somehow got himself onto when they first met him. So he's sat there in his back room, feeling sweaty. Michonne says goodbye and closes the door, but then we see that he actually has an ulterior motive. He's been removing floorboards from the floor using his machete.
Ooh.
Now,
kind of squeaky. They show him removing, what, 3 or 4 boards, and they're like really making loud noises, right?
Yeah, this is really problematic. This church is quiet as hell. For once, Judith has shut a trap, and she's not making any noise.
That little there isn't, jerk.
There isn't a chance in hell that Michonne and Carl, who are already a little bit sort of concerned about Gabriel, would not notice the noise of floorboards being wrenched up
and
from
his
room.
And there's no way in hell that Michonne, especially, would allow him to be alone in his office for more than a, you know, half an hour or 20 minutes at a time. It's just, it's unrealistic.
Yeah. So anyway, Gabriel's leaving. Now, there's a couple of theories as to why he might be leaving. Number one, he's just horrified at these people's behavior. He doesn't feel safe. The Lord will protect him. He's going to go off on his own. But we're starting to have suspicions about Gabriel's motivations in this show.
Okay, so he's going to go. He's going to head off. He does stop outside the church. He gets outside the church. He looks at the wall. He sees the, you know, you'll burn for this, which he looks really kind of upset about, but he kind of, you know, deals with it. He turns to walk and he steps. And when he steps, he steps on something.
A nail that has somehow miraculously pointed itself upwards.
He gets a nail through the foot. Now, you know, I'm not an expert on religious symbology, but something about a nail through the foot seems to ring a bell to me.
I mean, this is just another example of how silly this episode was for me.
We don't want to crucify this episode. But at the same time, it definitely has a cross to bear.
This is an example of how silly this episode was. Because simultaneously, it combines like a physically implausible act of a nail somehow finding its way deep into a leather shoe.
I got to point out, there's a good 3 inches of blood on that particular nail as he pulls it out.
Yeah, he pulls it out. That looks painful as hell.
Oh, but he grimaces really well.
Yeah, it is a good grimace. He's going to need a tetanus, for sure. But anyway, so it... All right, so Jesus fucking Christ, Steve, you've interrupted my train of thought again.
Jesus fucking Christ. This is going to play really well to our Newfoundland fans.
Yeah, they'll love it.
I just on a brief segue, when I was about, 13 years old, I made friends with my first Newfie friend. Mm-hmm. I went over to his house, spent the evening, it was great. Came back home. I was a good boy. My mom says, how was your trip? How was your visit? Oh, it was fucking great. It was fucking great. I really enjoyed the fucking Jackmans. They were fucking great, man.
That was Steve's racist tirade.
No! I love Newfies.
You love them, don't you?
I love Newfies. I do. Yeah. I do.
You love their simple ways.
No, I'm
and their colorful language.
I'm not saying that. The colorful language, yes. Perhaps.
Yeah. Why don't you get one, Steve?
Several Doofies.
You just get one and just keep it in your house. You can pet it.
I would.
Come out and say cute things in that colorful little accent.
Every now and again, I pull them out just for the amusement factor. It'd be great. Tom. I know you're listening. But
lovely. All right.
Where were we?
Yeah,
we were talking about the nail through the
I'm going to make this point now. All right.
This scene
encapsulated the silliness of this episode for me in two ways.
Oh.
Do not interrupt me.
Woo.
Number one, okay, it combines the sort of the physical implausibility, you know, of a nail just sticking in someone's
foot. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. At the same time as just hitting you over the head with unnecessary symbolic nonsense, you know? Like, it's completely unnecessary.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, we've
absolutely
already got the idea that this guy is religious. He's a fucking priest!
Yeah.
You know, well, what's the point?
Symbolically, the when point? You wear the collar, it gives you the certain religious connotation to everything
exactly.
you do.
What's the point of putting nails in his feet? Right? What is the point?
Well,
Gabriel's escaped the church. We don't know why. He wanders off through the woods, and suddenly he's acting all nervy. He can hear a kind of vague rustling. A ninja zombie just jumps out from behind a tree, because as we know, they're so sneaky and sly
and nimble.
And adept at obscuring themselves. So she jumps out, and actually, she's a pretty good zombie. I really liked her face. In the comics, whenever they draw zombies, they do this really good effect. Like, all the skin around the mouth is dried up and drawn back, so the teeth are really prominent. And yeah, and the makeup, I don't know if this was a makeup
teeth
or prosthetic.
And gums, man. Teeth and gums.
It looked like a person's face.
Hot.
But it was excellent. It was really, really well done. So she starts reaching out to Gabriel, and he's got his hand on her head, and you can see he's like just wants to push her away. But then he picks her up and slams her down. So we can see that this guy's got a lot of power. She falls on a small exposed stump and she's ripped to shreds. Her guts are all hanging out.
He picks up a rock, a good 50 pounder.
Gabriel has this skill of finding large rocks out in the middle of the woods. Like, the first time we met him, he's sitting on one here. He's found an enormous boulder in what is basically a jungle. More power to him. He raises it up, but he can't finish this zombie off.
He has this wonderful kind of play across his face of, like, you know, desire to destroy destroy, but inability to do so, kind of fear and kind of the sense of guilt. But, you know, what ultimately stays his hand, he looks down and what does he see?
He sees a cross.
He sees a cross on her neck and he's like, okay, she's a Christian, I can't do this. He is still unable to kind of move beyond the symbolism of his Christian background. Yeah. And in fact, the kind of symbolism that he himself is living. With the nail through the foot, yeah.
He's like a reverse vampire, you know? Like his life force is sustained by the proximity of crosses.
I think you're stretching here a little bit.
Anyway.
I like the idea, but you're completely wrong. You know where I really want to go right now? I want to go to fucking Atlanta. Okay, so episode 3 was, the end was Daryl coming out of the woods. Episode 4 was Beth. Episode 5 was flashbacks with Abraham and co. Episode 6 was Daryl and Daryl and Carol with flashbacks again. Carol's flashbacks. So we've been several episodes now. Episode 7, suddenly we skip. We go to not Daryl revealing Noah's existence to Michonne and co. It's like the next day, right?
Right. Thanks for bringing us up
Can
to speed.
Can you take over at this point? Please help me.
So we're in it. All right. So so Rick has assembled the group that he thinks he needs to get this job done. They're in
but,
the cube
van. But only
van.
Because Michonne has basically told him, I'll take them all. And Rick's like, nah, I owe this to Carol.
Michonne's like, for the sake of dramatic tension, I think I'm going to hang out in the church for this next episode.
Because, you know, that way we have a kick-ass character here to come and rescue your ass when you fuck up.
Yeah. And Rick's like, okay, well, we could stand here and justify this because of Carol or something, but whatever, let's just go to the cube van. So they head off in the cube van, and the plan at the moment, at this point in time, is just to head into that hospital and just basically kill anyone who stands in the way and get those guys out.
Oh yeah, Rick's got all the slitting of throats and the taking out of cops kind of planned out right from the get-go.
En route in the cube van, we have very touching scenes between Tyrese and Sasha, setting up the fact that Sasha's still very upset about Bob's death, blah blah blah. But we finally get to what looks like a FEMA camp on the outskirts of the city, somewhere that looks like it's been napalmed rather badly. But this is going to be the staging area for the rescue. They come up with this plan of going into the hospital, slitting throats, scampering around, but Tyrese doesn't like the sound of this.
Yeah, basically he says, we don't have to kill anybody. We take hostages, we do an exchange. And seriously, though, you and I watch the news.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of, you know, knowledgeable somewhat about history.
We're informed chaps.
How does it work when you've got hostage exchanges going on? Does it work well?
No. It routinely ends up in either the hostages being killed or the hostage takers being killed.
On the surface of it, when I'm watching this, I'm going, yeah, okay, Rick's going to listen to this and go, Tyrese, you're an idiot. This isn't going to happen.
Daryl, who has never been anything other than deferential to Rick, and he's actually been quite explicit about that fact, and he says, no, listen to Tyrese.
Tyrese has a good idea.
His plan works. No one has to die.
No one dies.
Ever the lieutenant. So do you think that this signifies Daryl coming out from behind the shadow of Rick? Or do you think it's supposed to signify that Rick is going too far in his new sort of mean, no-holds-barred persona?
I actually think it signifies neither of those things.
Yeah.
I think it signifies Daryl's extreme emotional connection to the two women who are trapped inside the hospital. I think he wants to make sure that neither of them dies.
Right.
And so he's willing to take kind of the diplomatic road, right? Like, ultimately, Tyrese's road is the diplomatic road. He wants to take a couple of hostages. Yes, there's going to be violence involved with that, but nobody dies, hopefully. And ultimately, they get a chance to take those women out of the hospital without violence.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually decide to follow through on this. And then we get a connection here because we had, early in the hospital, Dawn speaking with her cop friend about the gunshots, right?
Mm-hmm.
So who is firing that gun?
That's Noah hanging out at the FEMA camp.
Indeed. He's firing off the gun just to get their attention.
He fires it off a couple times. To lure a couple of police officers in there.
And here we have one of the stupidest moments of this whole episode.
Definitely.
Now, Rick is trained as a cop. Not only is he trained as a cop, but he was shot at the beginning of the season. Not the season, of this
show.
Series, right? That was the whole premise. He was shot. He was stuck in a hospital. He knows kind of, you know, at this point, you learn from that. You know what not to do. For one thing, you keep cover, right? Now, when he's got two cops with guns drawn on Noah, rather than standing behind in cover with his advantage of numbers and automatic machine guns saying, drop your weapons, what does he do instead?
He whistles and wanders out slowly.
He wanders out. And they all come out totally into the open. Yeah, a trained cop's probably going to see this as a situation where they need to de-escalate. So that's one of the cops actually puts his gun down and does that. But there's no guarantee in this world, as bad as it is, that anybody's going to put their gun down, right?
No.
So people will probably die. I mean, I'm looking at that situation. I'm watching it when I'm watching on Sunday night. I'm going, you know, in a real world situation with the stakes as high as they are here, somebody is going to die in this moment. And yet somehow he reads the situation right, luckily, stupidly, I would argue, and the cops both put their guns down. Does this make any sense?
Not too much. It makes more sense than certain things that happen in a few minutes to either. So the point being, they've got their two police hostages.
Hostages, yeah.
Good old Bobby Lamson and sort of whiny female cop.
And just to point out at this point that Noah does point out that Bobby is one of the good guys.
Yeah.
He's one of the good cops.
And we already know he's a good guy because as he's cuffing Noah with a zip tie, as far as I know, cannot be loosened. He says, let me know if this is too tight.
Because I'll loosen it for you, which is actually impossible, but
yeah.
I'm such a nice guy.
But whatever, I'll find I'm a nice guy. Let's just do this. Come on. Look at my soft features. I'm well-spoken. I don't want to die. I just want to sleep in my bed.
He's also ambiguously African-American, which is an interesting place to be at,
mm-hmm.
which enables him to be in kind of a neutral position between the power structures that currently make up America and are certainly like cause for discussion and debate today. Yeah, so
we did Giangameshi last week. There's no way I'm doing Ferguson this week.
Ferguson.
So they've got their two cop hostages. So they've arrested the cops, and yeah, something ridiculous happens.
They arrested the cops? Yeah. I love that terminology. That's really
good. Well, they have arrested them, really, haven't
kind
they?
Kind of, yeah.
They've disarmed them.
They've put them into Ziplocs. Yeah.
They've charged them. They put them down on the floor. And Bob Lamson makes an interesting observation about Rick. He says, hey, let me ask you a question.
Based on the way you're holding yourself.
There's something on my mind. Based on the way you're holding yourself.
And the way you talk.
Like, he holds himself like a feral coyote at the moment. He doesn't hold himself like a cop at all.
He holds himself like a predator.
He just holds himself like a desperate person. But Bob Lamson says, you know, the way you hold yourself, you're obviously a police officer. This is the beginnings of a sort of bond between them. Now, it's quite
clear.
And
to point out, this is what, how long? I mean, seriously, dude, this was like 12 seconds into their initial meeting, right?
And of course, it's interesting for us watching it, but thinking, well, yeah, he is a police officer, so how is he going to deal with this tension?
Well, and interesting, you and I, on our conversation outside of this whole podcast and show, we talked about the possibility of the fact that Rick's training as a cop might affect the way he interacts with these cops in Atlanta, right?
Yeah, you'd imagine, yeah. Something's got to click back in. Like, I mean, sure, Rick for the last year or so has, gone off the rails a little bit. But he's spent a long time as a police officer. These are other cops. This is something he's very familiar with.
Well, it's not just the fact that he was a long time as a cop. I mean, you look at all of season one, all of season two, he was playing the cop.
Yeah.
All the way through, yeah.
And he's there with Shane, another cop, for much of the time, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not like he falls immediately out of the habit.
Shane is the cop gone bad. Rick is the cop still holding to his ideals.
Yeah.
So it was a really interesting dichotomy. Now Rick is the fuck everything, I'm going to do what I need to do to survive.
Yeah. Because as Bob Lamson says later, all the cops are gone.
We discussed this a little bit. You don't really trust Bob, do you?
I don't trust him because the show is just screaming at us to trust him.
I know, but maybe call me naive, but I actually kind of think this guy has some potential. And there's a couple of reasons for this. The two cops are captured. Suddenly, a station wagon shows up, just backs into the alleyway where they are.
Implausibly, they would hear it coming a mile off, as was established. Everything's very quiet, but then this...
Total bullshit.
Waving an AK out the window, blah, blah. Somehow gets
firing lots of bullets.
Car.
The two cops get into the car, they take off.
Yeah, it's nonsense. Everyone knows it's nonsense.
Sasha is awesome. She takes out the tire, you know. So they show up, they end up coming to a stop. The group chases after them. They see two cops running away, but interestingly, not three.
Yeah, I love Rick. Rick's like, hey, I've got two on me.
There's two on me.
Because two, well, that's 66% isn't bad. And then Daryl thinks, hey, wouldn't it be interesting if I just stayed here next to the cop car?
He's not being incautious. He's checking things out. He opens the door to the car. He goes and opens the FEMA trailer, which is interesting, half burned out. They're surrounded by all these incredibly well-detailed, half-melted walkers.
Some beautiful stuff.
Oh, it is. They're melted into the pavement.
They look really good.
They're really well done.
Yeah.
Basically, you've got a whole set of walkers that are melted into the pavement. This is a result of the napalm attacks on Atlanta that we saw back in season one when Laurie and Sean were, Shane were watching the planes flying over the city.
Yeah, Nicotero is really delivering on his promises to give us more degraded zombies as well. These things are just falling apart.
Suddenly, Mr. Bullheaded Bald Cop comes out of nowhere and attacks. So Daryl is fighting for his life. He's being choked. He's rolling around. He stupidly and suicidally sticks his fingers into a walker's mouth a couple of times. Which just, I'm looking at that going, this is so fucking staged.
To me, right? This, I don't know. I wonder what you think. This scene, so we've basically got Daryl scrabbling around on the ground. He's in a fight with someone who's kind of physically much bigger than him. It's a one-on-one gladiatorial combat.
Mano a mano.
Now, this really reminded me of a certain scene in Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, we're talking about the Viper in the Mountain. The Viper in the Mountain, episode 7 of season 4.
Which also involves some strategic use of the eyeball.
That's one way to put it.
Honestly, I feel like this was an explicit sort of rejoinder to that scene.
And using the head as a fucking blunt weapon.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that, and I absolutely agree. They're definitely mimicking what happens in the episode titled The Mountain, the Viper.
I truly believe it was intentional.
I think it is. I hadn't thought of this before, but I totally agree with you. I think you're right on the spot here.
So what Daryl does is he's reaching out for something to hit this guy with. It's the standard sort of, we get this scene in movies all the time. Someone's getting choked. Someone's reaching around for something to hit the guy with, and all he's got a snapping zombie.
In Talking Dead later on that evening, they talk about how there's actually sort of a puppeteering mechanism inside the eyeballs of that particular zombie so that Norman Reedus is able to manipulate it and make the spinal cord move around as he was moving the skull around.
Yeah, because when he actually wrenches it free of its shoulders, it's still wriggling.
Oh, yeah, and that's actually Norman Reedus puppeteering.
Yeah. It was pretty good. I mean,
it was well done. It was well done.
All the inconsistencies aside, I mean, the idea that the spine would separate so simply, yet the skull would still be hard enough to make for a decent weapon to smash the guy in the face. Like, who gives a shit? It did look really good.
I mean, he smashes the skull against the cop's head a couple of times. The cop stands up. He goes, okay, asshole, you got the spot, whatever.
Because by that point, Rick has turned up.
With a gun.
He's nailed two of the zombies that are threats to Daryl.
And again, we get a huge dose of stupid here, because Rick stretches his arm out at full length, points the gun in the cop's face, and, like, okay, I'm sorry, but anybody who's trained in this shit is just going to move his head out of the way. And like, fuck you, you're not shooting me. But Rick, it's like he's forgotten all of his training.
Yeah, Rick's gone a bit mental. We're supposed to feel a little bit afraid of Rick in this scene, I think. Like, he's going over the edge. Like, Daryl has to calm him down. And this isn't for the first time that people have had to pull him back from, you know, doing some atrocities.
Yeah, there's about a 4 or 5 second pause where he's got the gun in the cop's face. And it's pretty obvious he wants to shoot the cop. But, yeah, Daryl talks him down out of it.
I feel like this is really projecting to next week. I mean, I feel like Rick is going to either he's going to break with protocol and do something violent that might cause problems, or we are going to realize that Rick's violence is actually completely essential to this group's survival.
But exactly.
They're certainly setting something up on those lines.
But we're not going to find out right away. No. Ultimately, they end up with 3 hostages, right? They end up going to a some sort of a warehouse. They got the 3 cops tied up.
And they decide that they're going to pick 2 of them and go in and exchange them. Because Bob Lamson has started to cooperate. He says, no, you know what? Your plan is going to work. And he fills Rick in on what he needs to do.
He tells him that, like, Don won't agree to your deal right away, but trust me, keep trying. She'll break. The other 2 cops, really interestingly, there's a woman cop and there's the cop that had the big fracas with Daryl. They say, hey, you know what? Don doesn't have control. Let us go. We'll take her out. We'll let your people go. And to be perfectly honest, when I'm watching this scene, I'm seeing the 2 of them talking. I think they're on the up and up. I think they're on the up and up. I think they're seriously saying, yeah, if you let us go, we'll take Don out. We'll let Beth and Carol go.
What have they got to lose?
Exactly.
Like, honestly, they've got nothing to lose. Carol and Beth are not assets in any way.
No.
You've got someone's half dead and someone's just annoying. Like, I don't understand why it was so difficult to get these people out in the first place.
Yeah.
I don't even know why the cops need those people.
Presumably, we the viewers have an investment in a character like Beth. We definitely have an investment in a character like Carol.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people writing these episodes and running these episodes, Scott Gimple and his friends, assume that we have this investment. And so they're playing off of that.
Evil men.
They are. They're assuming that because we have an investment, that Dawn and her people have an investment too, when they don't. They really don't.
No, they don't. And unfortunately, we don't really have an investment in seeing their comeuppance. Like I said in the last episode, we need to see cops doing some mean stuff in order to care about what happens in the hospital. Like, if Dawn gets shot, I don't care.
No, but Gorman was a prick.
Yeah.
And he would have been a good character to keep along, because then we would have been very happy to see Beth and or Carol take him out.
Mm-hmm.
But he was taken out by that one woman who had her arm cut off.
We can't remember her name, can we?
No, but she was the actress from the Whale Rider.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's kind of weird. It's like, I understand the mid-season finale is going to be a big assault on the hospital, yet at the same time, I don't really care too much about those guys in the hospital. So I'm hoping they throw us a curveball and they introduce some tension in some other way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of interesting that Bob Lampson escapes and is heading off in the direction of the hospital. That, you know.
It's an interesting sequence because he basically tries to play on Sasha's humanity, because he says, I saw this guy out there. He's half melted. I recognized him. It could have been me. Can you take him out for me?
Why the hell would you sympathize with a person in this situation, Steve?
Because his name is Bob.
Yeah, that was convenient. Bob Lampson seems quite prescient, doesn't he? Like, he understood straight away that Rick was a police officer. He knew that Sasha would be quite sympathetic to the idea of putting someone out of their misery, and he had the forethought to be christened Bob.
He's like Super Cop. he's fucking Super Cop, right?
Yeah, so
Bob Lampson,
he seems a bit omniscient.
Absolutely. And it's rather convenient that he's suddenly in this position, because if he was Mr. Fucking Omniscient Cop, Dawn would not be running things.
Yeah, I mean, you could usurp Dawn in 2 seconds. She's fragile. She's got a tenuous grip on that place. Yeah, again, right. Already, we're trying to rationalize it and figure out how it might happen. The point is, the storyline is not completely watertight.
I think the word is stupid.
A little bit stupid. A little bit weak. A little bit lazy, let's be honest. And that's it's kind of a problem. It's like, every episode so far has been good. Like, you know, you could pick fault with it here and there, and we're like, oh, we'll grumble about this, but you really have to find something.
To me, this was definitely the weakest episode of the whole bunch.
This it was falling apart. Like the seams are, like, ripped open, the fluff's everywhere, and the showrunner's like, well, screw it, let's just play with the feathers.
I do want to point out at this point that that Dan and I did talk about this episode whilst I had not watched it. When I was on holidays for the weekend, so I did not see it until Tuesday. And he said, oh, no, this had so many stupids in it, I just can't even describe it. But watch it. And my initial reaction was, okay, I'll take the positive viewpoint. I will take this as, you know, happy fanboy. Let's see what's good about it, and you and I can argue in the review. However, I watched it, and I ended up writing stupid 5 times in my margins. So, and unfortunately, those 5 stupids kind of coincided with some of the stupids you had in your head.
Yeah.
So, now, caveat here. This is still, compared to most television, much better.
Like, yeah.
It's actually a very good show. And unfortunately, what's happening here is, because they know they're a good show, they're expecting us to be able to suspend disbelief a little bit beyond the reality, beyond the pale.
Yeah.
We're not just a bunch of stupid fucking viewers who want to just get entertained. We want intelligent television.
Yeah, there were much simpler ways to get to where they were going to get to the end of the show. Because this episode didn't matter too much.
This is a setup. It's a total setup, yeah.
All it needed to do was to be marginally entertaining and get us there and, you know, build up the tension. But they just took too many liberties, too slapdash, and it didn't work too well for me. I got to say, this is my least favorite. Even though it was a lot of fun, I kind of, like, viscerally enjoyed it. Like, some of the violence was good. Like, it was exciting. It was nice to keep flitting between, and I enjoy the Tara stuff. It was all nonsense. It made me giggle. But I feel tonally it was a real departure from the rest of the season so far.
Well, and there's this at the same time, the sense that even though this is the least of the episodes this season, it's still better than pretty much anything in season 2.
Yeah.
And pretty much on par with almost anything in season 3.
Yeah.
So it's as bad as it was for tonight, or sorry, for this week, it's still a pretty good television program overall.
Oh yeah, this is a good kid. We're not mad, we're just disappointed.
Yeah, I'm not spanking him.
All right, so we might as well move on to the pièce de résistance of stupid moves. So yes, they all agree that this is the best thing to do. So they take the bull cop and the female cop. and they're heading off to the hospital to...
We'll leave Sasha with that guy named Bob, because that has no connotations whatsoever.
Let's do that. She's obviously mentally fragile. She's too close to this guy. We'll leave her with him, and we'll sneak off to the hospital and execute our plan. So there's two things that are fucked up here. So number one is this whole ridiculous scene of Sasha goes upstairs, buys this guy's line, turns her back on him, leans out the window. What's going to happen? I was hoping, really, really hoping, that he would just pitch her straight out the window. Like, that would have been worth it. Because as it was, this show ended in a weak-ass way. It ended...
Because he hits her. He body checks her into the window.
Yeah. And she
hits her head.
What happens? The window doesn't even break, I don't think. Like, her head dents against it, and she's knocked out. Which doesn't happen. Yeah. It does not happen.
And he runs out like a fucking asshole.
It does not
like
happen. He runs off with his hands tied behind his back, and then that's it. Fade to black. Like, no tension at all. Like, weak-ass ending. Yeah, but then the other silly thing about it is this. So their plan now is to go back into Atlanta and then play their card.
Oh, dude, they're totally in...
They're in Atlanta. Atlanta. They're a mile away.
No, literally, they are a mile away, because that was how far away the gunshot was. And this is another big fucking problem, right? Dude, do you remember? They heard the gunshot, right?
This is the point. Yeah, this is what I'm getting.
Noah's one single gunshot from a small pistol. So, automatic gunfire. Do they hear any of that? Do they react to it? Do they react?
No.
By
rights, there should be... Right, so the hospital has heard all of that. They've heard a massive, sustained gun battle coming from the direction in which three of their police officers have just gone.
And Don Lerner and the rest are going, oh... Well, that sounds like there's some problem off to the northeast.
We'll just ignore that and...
Get me a nice cup of tea.
Let's watch a DVD.
They suddenly turn really British with extremely vacuous South London accents. Yeah.
We could investigate that, but first we have to find out what happened to these strawberries.
And she turns to her officer, is your DVD recharged?
So let's bring it to an end, okay. Steve.
I'm quite happy with this episode in the sense of... It moved things forward. It gave us a sense of what's coming in the next week. But ultimately, there was really no narrative flow to this. Uh-huh. There were a lot of problems for me.
Yeah, a fair few problems. And there's not an awful lot of payoff that seems to be coming next week.
I agree. There wasn't a lot of movement. I honestly think that the only thing that happened here was simply a stopgap for next week. And the only way they're going to recoup things is by killing people.
Yeah.
So to kill people off next week is going to end up feeling somewhat cheap.
But they have to. They absolutely have to. Because we're going to get no satisfaction from the cops dying in the hospital. The only thing that is going to touch us is one or two of our regular cast members getting killed.
There's no way around it. I suspect Beth, possibly Carol... are going to be dead at the end of next week.
Which will be annoying, because it'll make it pointless going to the hospital.
Well, I really want Carol to stay alive.
I'm hoping one of them survive, and it's someone who's going to rescue them and gets killed.
Well, that's
going to
be Carol. Because as much as I do like how Beth has arced, I think her arc's finished.
Listen, Steve.
Yep.
We got to call it, man. This is like an hour and 45.
I think we're... Holy crap. This has been... a wonderful moment.
This has been wonderful, man.
Oh, an hour and 40 minutes.
It's been really good talking to you twice this week about
yes,
the same topic.
All right,
one day I'll admit that there was no power cut.
This is a problematic episode, which is one of the reasons why, even after editing, we went really long. Also, the fact that we've both been drinking tonight, so that's another thing.
So we should apologize for the show being out late this week.
Yeah, sorry about that. Hopefully we don't have power outages. We have battery backups for next week, so we'll be covered. We will be doing a really good, hopefully intensive investigation of that last episode, which is happening in like 4 nights. And we're going to be doing a series of shows over the break, so I hope you guys tune in. I'm really looking forward to exploring new aspects of media with Dan over the next several weeks. Yeah, so...
So, thanks a lot for listening. We really appreciate it. Sorry that it was out so late this week. We'll try not to let that happen again. Cheers, Steve.
It was a pleasure. Cheers, Dan. Take
care,
mate.
Absolute pleasure, mate.
All right, good night.
Good night. Stop it.
That was fucking horrible.